as long as everything stays the same. I avoided the cure, but it found me anyway. I was looking for a redo, but my game hadn't changed. And hoping for a different outcome is insane. This is good, this is real, it's how it's supposed to feel. Right here and now, both feet planted on the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday morning. It is the 24th of September, 14 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. We are very happy to have you with us this morning, and we thank you as always. So let us begin. We have a lot to talk about, a lot of news, and we'll get right to it. We have a wonderful panel, and let me introduce them. I want to also remind you that you can write to us, panel@wamc.org. We'll read letters on the air. We can't get to all of them, but we get to quite a few. panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Well, I'm okay. Very good. Very good. It was raining like heck this morning, so I had to postpone my usual walk into the daylight hours. And that's one thing. Listen, Joe, we're doing very well. What's happening is we're going into a fun drive, and We all get nervous as a fun drive. Will everybody be there? Will people, you know, who tell us all the time how wonderful this station is, will they do something? Will they put something into the locked box? Well, on Monday, we begin, and we're going to be doing our best to justify our existence. That's what we do. And we're very happy that so many people have already put something in. Now, the one thing we could use now, and we didn't get around to asking earlier, but now we're asking. Anybody who can put a challenge in is very much appreciated. Challenges, as you probably know, everybody. Somebody says, okay, I have some extra money this year. I'll put in $5,000 or $10,000 or whatever I can do, or $1,000. And if people can match this in, and you make up your mind, 5 minutes or 10 minutes, or if you can do it, and it works. We don't know why it works, but it certainly works. The more challenges, the faster we go. And the one thing we know at a time like this, when we have, you know, frankly, a madman named Trump out there doing what he's doing, the faster we go, the better it is. Look, there's a very good chance Trump is going to run for president again, and that he will bring his anti-democratic standards into the marketplace. And so I'm just asking everybody to recognize how important it is, what you can do to help WAMC, and you can do it now. You can go to 1-800-323-9262. Again, 1-800-323-9262, and you can put something in. You can also issue a challenge, and challenges are very important. If you've got a challenge, why don't you get in touch with our wonderful Amber Sickles at WAMC.org and tell her, hey, I can do something here. We'd love to hear from you, and it would be great.
We want to just remind you that we will officially start attacking the locked box on Monday, and Alan and I will be taking this time from our time during the panel to talk about it. And it is really because we can't have a regular fun drive because of COVID and Delta and the like, and having a large staff in a very small room doesn't seem like a good idea. So, let me rephrase that. It isn't a good idea. So we're not going to do it. So we'll just do what we have to do until it's done.
Until it's done.
Right. And so whatever we do now and whatever we do in the early days of next week, we can get back to regularity, and won't that be nice? So WAMC.org, yeah.
And you know, Joe, we could do it in a day. We've come very close to doing that. If everybody decides, okay, this is an extraordinary time, we've got to protect our radio station, we got to do it, we could do it in a day. Now, you said something before, which is that on Monday we'll start something official. And I want everybody to know that anything I may have said this morning is not official. That doesn't start till Monday.
Well,
that's not official.
I said we'll attack it, meaning that we're going to take up all of the time working on it. Today we're mentioning it to put it on your plate to know it's coming down the line.
It's not official.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Any money you give us would be official, though. That counts.
Yes. You speak the truth.
WAMC.org, WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. All right. We'll remind you of that a couple times this morning, but good for you all to know. Let me introduce the panel to you, and we'll get started. We welcome Judith Enck, former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor of Bennington College, and president of Beyond Plastics. Hello, Judith.
Good morning. I'm officially well.
Good.
You're official.
Make it official. Welcome. We always love having you here. Thank you. SUNY New Paltz communications professor and former New York State Senator Terry Gibson is here. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Really nice to have you on the program, as always. Investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo. This isn't one of your normal days, but good morning.
Good morning. It's so exciting to be here on a Friday. You have such cool people on always.
Yes. Well, and you were nice enough to switch out with another panelist who needed to change. So we thank you very much for doing that. And
no problem.
Glad that you are here. So thank you.
Yeah, I think I may have gotten the better part of that deal, considering all the news that's happening.
Yeah, there's a lot happening. So let's get started. I just want I'm not saying we're going to start with it, but I'm just asking the panel as a group, do you want to talk about the Chris Cuomo story today? All right.
Yes.
Oh, Rosemary says yes. Anybody else?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should. It was an interesting op-ed from a pretty credible source.
Okay, so
you're gonna have to lay it out for people, Joe.
I will. Morning, right? It is. Yeah. It was an opinion piece in the Times. Okay, so I'll work on that. But let's start with the bigger news, which is the CDC chief overrules. The panel recommends Pfizer booster for workers at risk. Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the CDC director, reversed a move by agency advisors and endorsed boosters for healthcare workers, teachers, and others. Her highly unusual decision aligns with the FDA's recommendation and helps President Biden's plan to make booster shots available to more Americans. We've been talking a lot in the last couple of days about, confusion over this. And I think this does add to the confusion. I don't know what the, sometimes the media role is in this. But I think any way you look at it, if you were watching the news from, I would say, 3 o'clock to midnight last night, there were a lot of different messages that were coming out from various government agencies. So where we seem to stand right now is the director for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention overruled this recommendation by an agency advisory panel that had refused to endorse booster shots of the Pfizer COVID vaccine for frontline workers. It was a highly unusual move for Dr. Walensky, but align CDC policy with the FDA and their endorsements over her own agency's advisors. The CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices on Thursday recommended the boosters for a wide range of Americans, including tens of millions of older adults and younger people at high risk for the disease. But they excluded healthcare workers, teachers, and others whose jobs put them at risk. That put their recommendation at odds with the FDA's authorization of booster shots for all adults with a high occupational risk. Alan.
Well, you know, I think the FDA is right. I don't understand. We have a situation here in which we have the extension of the COVID, and people are going to die and get very ill as a result of this. Anything we can do, including the booster shots, to help is so important. Those of us who have other kinds of things, have a little diabetes, or those of us who are a little bit older, it's essential that it be done. And I got to tell you, I always get confused when I hear the idea that maybe it's premature to do it. Hey, when it comes to life, I think there's no such thing as premature.
Judith Henk.
Well, no one should be surprised that these two giant federal agencies, CDC and FDA, are feuding with each other. The sad reality is federal agencies fight with each other all the time, and it could get pretty brutal. And then I think what Dr. Waletsky did was she rose above that, and I'm sure she looked at the science herself, made a recommendation. The problem here, and again, not surprising that some scientists on this panel are hesitant to make recommendations. The problem is there's very limited research. This is not like, you know, the tragedy of cancer research, where people in labs have been doing cancer research for decades. Scientists don't like to move fast. And so I think she inserted herself in a very responsible way. Three quarters of Americans who are currently vaccinated said they want to get the boosters. Totally understandable. The government decided not to do reporting on breakthrough COVID. I think all of us know people in our social circles and families who got the vaccine, were careful, and still got COVID. That is happening more and more. So I think that's really driving the desire for the boosters. But I think the most important thing is we have to figure out a way to vaccinate the unvaccinated. The lowest vaccinated U.S. states have death rates four times higher than the most vaccinated states. And only three states account for one third of last week's deaths from COVID. And you won't be surprised to hear the states are Texas, Georgia, and Alabama. So while the booster debate is important and it's interesting because we're all trying to analyze what's best for our own health, I really implore the media to stay focused on the biggest threat, and that is unvaccinated people.
Rosemary Armeo.
Okay, so I saw this from the point of view of the agency rather than the media. So Judith and I actually switched roles here. I think people are indeed quite upset and confused when two big federal agencies that are both supposed to be looking at the science and both telling us what to do come out with different recommendations. And finally, the CDC director has learned that her job as a public official is very different from being a doctor and a scientist. And she took a wise political step. She made the FDA and the CDC come into alignment by saying, okay, everybody get the shot. Everybody who wants it should get the shot. I think that the media, I also struggled last night, as Joe said, to figure out what the heck was going on, because it is inherently confusing. For all the reasons that you all are talking about, scientists and slow research and all of that, but that's not what happens when you have a public crisis, a pandemic, and you're trying to tell the public what the best action is. You need to be clear and decisive. And finally, I think the CDC director has gotten it. She didn't go along with just the strict science and the recommendation of her own people. She said, no, we're going to go with, like, if you want the shot and you're over 65, you should get it, especially if you're in a public-facing position. I think it was smart, and it's the first time I've seen her act with political acumen.
So, Rosemary, where do you see Biden in all of this?
I think Biden perhaps has talked to her or had someone. I've been saying that for a long time. She's made a series of missteps. And I don't mean that she was a bad doctor or a scientist, the opposite. She was so much faithful to the traditions and the habits of her profession that she was not a good public policymaker. And that is what she is now. And I think somebody on Biden's staff has had to be talking to her about this. We've got to get confidence back in the CDC. And yeah, talk about the media. I'm not sure what the media can do to get past vaccine resistance other than being more respectful towards the other position, which I've spoken on. But I think that the government suffers from the same mistrust that the public has and that the media does. And this was a really big step forward. I do see Biden's hand in this.
Terry Gibson. Terry, we only have about 90 seconds, but I'll obviously give you more time on the other side of the break.
Well, I tend to agree with what's been said. It has been a real communication struggle for all of these agencies, and I think it has fed into a lot of the doubt and excuses that we hear about reasons not to take the vaccine. And I agree with what you said, that I would like to see the messaging really focus on getting those who are not vaccinated, rather than getting all caught up in the whole booster concept, which obviously is important. I do think this was a good day for Rachel Walensky, and I personally would like to see her presence more. I'd like to see her more at the helm of communicating exactly what the policy is. And I think if she could continue to speak as she has done on this one, that they would begin to move the messaging in a more clear direction.
All right. You came in right on time. Congratulations. I do want to, when we come back, I want to talk more about this. I also want to talk about this idea of the frontline workers and teachers and so forth and why that was an issue, because I find that interesting as well. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Our panel this morning, Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Terry Gibson, and Rosemary Armeo. We welcome your letters. Keep them short, keep them to the point, and we'll get to as many as we possibly can in the time that we have allotted. By the way, if you have a moment or two, wamc.org to help the locked box. We will be right back after this. Watkins Family Hours Music, they were playing their album Brother, Sister, and they'll be playing Levon Helm Studios tonight. You can find out more by going to levonhelm.com. You can also see our complete playlist posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. Welcome back to the panel discussion. We've got a good group here. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Terry Gibson, and Rosemary Armeo. And of course, as always, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. So I do want to ask this question, because I find it interesting, of the reason for the CDC or the Walensky, Dr. Walensky, overruling the FDA endorsement is that they excluded healthcare workers, teachers, and others whose jobs put them at risk. What is the rationale behind that? I don't understand. Is it as simple as teachers unions, or is it further than that?
Well, I think the National Teachers Union, Randy Weingartner, came out in support of teachers being vaccinated. I think unions are all over the map, which is most unfortunate. Some of them are making a process argument that this should be part of their bargaining agreement, which often takes months or, many cases, years. I didn't see any medical reason why these folks should not be vaccinated. So I think, Joe, you put your finger on it. There's probably some political pressure, but In New York State, our new governor, Kathy Hochul, has certainly been very clear about healthcare workers and teachers and bus drivers all getting vaccinated. And just seems to be common sense. If you're going to be in contact with the public every day, of course you should be.
David is mad at us. He said, can we all please stop saying there's confusion about the vaccines? It's always and consistently been very clear. Get vaccinated. Everything else is just details and noise. Any confusion to me is simply those who don't want to get the shot, flailing around to find any reason to say no, particularly those who know nothing about how science works. Rosemary, would you like to respond to David's note?
Yeah, I think that's the same, you know, snotty elitist attitude that we on the panel have been guilty of and have been yelled at for. There definitely is confusion, and there also is an importance of people in states less blue than our own fighting against their own government for vaccinations and masks and other restrictions, and having federal agencies saying, you should do this, this is our recommendation, gives them weight that's important to have. So I think clear and unified directions from the federal government are super important.
But, you know, to the point that we were talking before, what I think is different this time is that while there have been these different opinions, these different studies, these different committees come out with this different perspective on what we should do, Dr. Walensky has stepped forward and said, okay, I have listened to all the various perspectives. I've looked at your recommendations. This is what we're going to do. This will be the policy starting today. And I think that effort to bring clarity to it and move forward is extremely important.
Alan? Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. Alan?
Well, the reason I asked Rosemary the question before about, you know, the president of the United States, Joe Biden, and where he stands on this is it's quite clear to me that Walensky does not make a move like this without talking or getting communication from the president of the United States. And it seems to me you don't have to be a great doctor to just figure out what's right here. The more people you vaccinate, the more people who are in contact with the public, the better off you are. Again, I don't see Walensky as an independent operator.
You know, I do think that the thing, though, that the letter writer makes, the point they're making is that there's no confusion because you have to go get vaccinated. Right. I got it. I understand that. But there is confusion as all of this goes by. I mentioned this the other day, but yesterday. Go to a pharmacy and sit there for 10 minutes and watch the questions that they get. Okay, I heard this on CNN, I heard this on Fox, I heard this here, I heard this there. Can I get the shot? And they're the ones dealing with that information. There's a tremendous amount of confusion as to people of whether it has been approved, even now, can you go in today and get the shot or do you have to wait? Is there a date? So I think that is what we're talking about when we're talking about confusion. There's no confusion over whether you should, at least on the part, I think, of this panel, there's no confusion on whether you need to get vaccinated or not. But there is confusion as to who should get it, when they get it, you know, and just what we were just talking about of frontline workers and healthcare workers and teachers and so forth. So I think that is where there are questions, legitimate questions that people ask. And a lot of times, even when you go to your doctor's office or your pharmacy, I have found that if you go to the doctor's office, they'll schlough you off to the pharmacist. And then if you go to the pharmacist, they'll do their best, but often have difficulty because they haven't gotten clear guidance on it either. Judith?
Yeah, I think you're right. And then there's the overlay of state government.
Right.
You know, we're fortunate in the Northeast to have governors who do messaging based on science. But if you're in these terribly struggling states like Texas, Georgia, and Alabama, it's even more confusing. Forget about the booster. It's just getting people in for their first shot. And there was an article yesterday, and I think we need to really understand the significance of this. Half of people who are not vaccinated are saying they hope to get around to it, but they don't they haven't been able to make the time. You know, some of these people are working 2-3 jobs. There are a lot of frontline workers who are concerned about if they get the shot and then they're sick for 2 or 3 days afterwards. They don't have paid sick days. You know, one would think, hey, let's really prioritize this. We are in the middle of an international pandemic, but there are practical problems, according to this article, for about half of the people. The other half, unfortunately, are caught up in essentially culture wars around vaccines. Mm-hmm. Many are educated, advanced degrees. They're in the healthcare field. And I just think it's, you know, one of the most tragic moments in American history that something like getting a vaccine to protect your health and your family's health in the broader community becomes a Fox News talking point. It's just quite unbelievable.
Well, Joe, you know, to Judith's point and to this overall topic of confusion, it shouldn't surprise any of us. We are living in a nation that can't even agree that we have a fairly elected president. There's confusion about pretty much everything in this nation right now.
You make a point, yes.
And so this is part of it, that the access to disinformation, the access to 24 hours of bad and inaccurate information through social media and all the other forms it comes to us in, it's not surprising at all. And it does make being a clear, effective leader and communicator very, very difficult.
Rosemary?
When I listen to us, I begin to see why Biden has turned to giving vaccines to other countries, where it's a whole lot easier to convince people that this is a good thing and you should be getting it. And it actually is a really good thing for us as well, because this is a global pandemic. And there are places around the world that we have exchanges with. And if we're vaccinated and they are not, this is not to speak to long-term health. So I'm really happy to see that our excess vaccine capacity is not being wasted, that it's being used to help the world. And we're actually a little bit behind on this.
Assuming you aren't really underwater, Rosemary, you sound like you are. Yeah. So I will. Assuming that you're not in a dunk tank at a county fair, I will.
Wait, I tried something else. How's
yeah,
this?
Much better. Much better. The water. The water has dissipated. Fantastic.
No, I have not drowned.
Okay, good.
Glug, glug, glug.
Good to hear. Ricky writes to us and says, "I'd like to see more perks for those of us who are vaccinated against COVID. We should have to show proof of vaccination more often, like in order to board a plane, train, or a Greyhound bus. That seems to be the most realistic way to persuade people to get vaccinated." All right. Let's...
Good point. No one has ever asked me to see my vaccine card.
Oh, now see, I show it all the time, but I don't know.
Me neither.
Yeah, well, you don't
theaters.
Have one. Yeah, well, theater.
I've been asked in theaters.
Theaters do it, but I mean, even when I go see the doctor, if I go to a doctor's appointment, I've had it at museums. I've had it. I was up in Vermont in the weekend, and breweries were asking for it. So thought, oh, that's good.
Good.
But again, it's Vermont. Norm.
Highest vaccine rate in the country.
That's right.
Number one is Vermont.
Go Green Mountain State. Norm writes, scientists in general seem to be extremely egocentric. Each wants to be seen as the smartest and most analytical. It is presently like watching a large group of sausage makers collectively making one sausage with no recipe. They're not embarrassed at the daily jumbled result because they're scientists and not pragmatists. It's painful to watch. That's an interesting letter, and only because, maybe not only, but certainly for one big reason, that I think it's the one letter that we've gotten that is critical of the scientists.
Yeah, and I think it's a very unfair criticism. I think scientists by nature are cautious, and they need data. They need tons and tons of data. They spend years looking at things, and the pace of this international pandemic doesn't provide that luxury. So the culture in science is to be cautious and to take your time. And that's not really an option here. I don't think it's because they're egotistical and they'd like to get their name in the paper. And in fact, it's often the opposite. Most scientists shy away from public recognition. Very unfair letter.
One more letter, and we'll go to a break, and then we'll move on to other stuff. Thea writes, providing boosters to high-risk populations does not preclude pushing vaccination of unvaccinated individuals. Unfortunately, there has been an abundance of vaccine over the past few months, and yet a huge portion of the U.S. remains unvaccinated. I'm a healthcare provider in my early 60s, and quite honestly, I would have retired today if boosters had not been approved for those like myself. It's unfair to ask healthcare workers to provide care to reckless anti-vaxxers while not maximizing protections to us. That from Thea. We'll take a break, and we'll be right back and move on to other topics. Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Terry Gibson, and Rosemary Armeo making up the panel on this Friday. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the discussion this morning. So I mentioned this early on about ask the panel for their input, and they agreed to do this. So here we go. I wanted to address the opinion piece in this morning's New York Times from Shelley Ross entitled "Chris Cuomo Sexually Harassed Me. I Hope He'll Use His Power to Make Change." This is a very interesting opinion piece in the Times. This is from Shelley Ross, who is a veteran television journalist, a former executive producer at ABC and CBS. What I find most interesting about her position is that she was Chris Cuomo's boss. And in fact, that's the first line of her opinion piece. I was Chris Cuomo's boss at ABC News nearly two decades ago, and I'm a regular viewer of CNN Today. So I've long watched how he communicates on camera and witnessed at times how he behaved behind the scenes. So she goes through in this piece talking about these moments that led her to ultimately write this. One was when the governor first addressed the sexual harassment charges and apologized for acting in a way that made people feel uncomfortable. And then then Chris Cuomo explained to CNN viewers a few days later that because of that scandal, he can no longer be covering this. And he said, "I have always cared very deeply about these issues and profoundly so. I just wanted to tell you that." She says the second moment of reckoning came for her on Labor Day weekend after Cuomo had resigned. And as his loyal confidants and advisors were losing their own jobs in the fallout, Chris Cuomo was in the Hamptons appearing in a photo wearing a T-shirt emblazoned with the word "truth." She writes, "For me, his statement of profound concern about sexual harassment and his truth T-shirt were provocations in this era of personal accountability." So then she goes on to tell that she was at a party and Chris Cuomo wrote an email to her saying, the subject line of the email was, "Now that I think of that, I am ashamed." And she said that she says she was sexually harassed at the party because there was a point where she was changing jobs. He hugged her and grabbed her rear end. And Cuomo said,
"I
can."
And her husband was looking on.
Her husband was right there. Yeah, I can do this now, and you're no longer my boss. In fact, she questions whether the reason that the letter was even written is because her husband was there. In this, she actually shows the email, the text of the email. What I find to be most interesting about this piece is the line, "I have no grudge against Mr. Cuomo. I'm not looking for him to lose his job. Rather, this is an opportunity for him and his employer to show what accountability can look like in the Me Too era." So I want to go around and ask, if you are not looking for him to lose his job, then what does accountability look like for Chris Cuomo? Rosemary?
Well, I think it's a pretty arch letter because, of course, she would like to see him lose his job. She wouldn't have written it otherwise. And I am not blaming the victim. I never do that. But I want to again say that I so support women standing up for one another. She needed to make a complaint about this at the time it happened, not just now. But that said, I'm glad she's come forward now. And I do think Cuomo needs to respond, and CNN does. Do I think that he'll be booted? No, I'm afraid not, unless we hear from other people saying the same thing. So the countdown on Cuomo has begun, I would say. Usually, if you look at the pattern during Me Too, it's taken multiple women saying, yeah, he did this to me too. Oh, somebody's at my door.
Tell me, say hi.
I don't actually see anything really happening.
You know, but you say I understand what you're saying. You say that the countdown now is on Chris Cuomo. But Judith, it seems like the countdown was down in March of this year when it was found out, you know, he was talking about it. And because of his close relationships, people were calling for his removal then.
Yeah, I mean, I always thought it was weird that CNN let him interview his brother. And then it was revealed that he was coaching his brother on how to get around these serious harassment charges. We now know he was coaching them because he has some personal experience. If you read the email that's superimposed in the Times article this morning, or Times op-ed, I should say, you know, it's a very legalistic email where he's trying to cover his tracks. And it tracks with what he told his brother to do at first. Remember, if I'm remembering, the advice he gave was not to deny it, but to acknowledge that, you know, there was confusion over intent. And if I hurt anyone, I apologize. And so it seems like the Cuomo brothers have a playbook for these situations. I think it's very brave that Shelley Ross came forward. The fact that she printed out and saved this email from 2005 means that this deeply affected her. You know, it's not about sex. It's about power. And what Ms. Ross, who was very prominent, she was his boss at a network, she wrote, this was a hostile act meant to diminish and belittle his female former boss in front of her staff. So I think she's bringing up some important issues. I think a lot of people are going to read this and say, oh, you know, he did a bear hug and he touched her behind. What's the big deal? You know, man up. The fact is, you know, there are different gradations of sexual harassment. And she writes in this article, you can't have a sliding scale. So I think she, you know, I think she's doing a service to the public because people pay attention to what public figures do. And there's quite a good chance that she's not the only person who experienced this. And so we'll see if anyone else comes forward. And often it's women who are in positions of authority who can go first. But this happened in 2005. She's a very senior media executive, and it took this long for her to tell her truth.
Judith, it struck me that the offense that she charged him with was worse than some of the charges brought against his brother 15 years later, more than 15 years later. So things have changed, and that makes a difference. But also, had she acted at the time, she was more powerful than him. He has now become a leading star of CNN, and so ousting him or getting accountability is harder. The other thing you point out correctly is that it would be very interesting indeed, as she points out, to find out exactly what he did for his brother. He claimed, oh, I'm not a consultant, I'm a brother. But there's a big difference between the two. Did he write memos? Was his advice followed? What exactly was he saying about CNN at the time? It's a terrible ethical conflict, and CNN has not addressed that at all.
Terry?
Well, from the day that CNN decided not to let Chris Cuomo go, I pretty much wrote them off as an entertainment company and no longer really consider them to be a credible news organization. So I could live without Chris Cuomo, and I think the world could too. And I really think it would be in CNN's best interest from a public relations standpoint to let him go. It's just going to be an issue that continues to be there, and they seem to be incapable of addressing it. And I do think that as we get more access to the Attorney General's investigation, we may very well find out more about how Chris Cuomo was involved in this.
Alan Chartok.
I'm listening very carefully to the women on the panel and what they have to say. I do know one thing. People hug all the time. Nevertheless, when you hug and then you put your hand on somebody's posterior, that seems to me to be absolutely desultory, if that's the right word, absolutely insulting, and should not have happened. It's that simple.
We have a letter writer who wrote and said, "How is that harassment and not assault?"
Well, it's referenced in the short email that Chris Cuomo sent to Shelley Ross. He says, Christian Slater got arrested for a, quote, parens, kind of similar act, parens, though born of an alleged negative intent, unlike my own. So he, like, why is he bringing that up?
That is legal. Yeah, that's a legalese. Yeah, that's interesting. Anyone else on that? All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll go to letters. We will also move on to other topics. We have a terrific panel this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Ink, Terry Gibson, and Rosemary Armeo. We welcome your input, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
And 700 more to your arms from this pallet on the floor. It's been a while, 10 years or more. Still, my heart is your prisoner of war. It's a long way down a broken road back to where I'm from. California's fading in the sun. Somewhere along this lonesome road I abandoned my love. But please don't.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday morning, the 24th of September, 5 minutes past 10 o'clock. We welcome you to our discussion if you're just joining us. And we have Alan Chartok, Judith Ink, Terry Gibson, and Rosemary Armeo. I want to finish up on the Chris Cuomo discussion, and then we'll move on to other topics. We have a couple of letters on this that I'd like to get to. Ryan says, the incident described in the Chris Cuomo piece involves him grabbing her bottom. How is this harassment and not assault, or at least abuse? That was similar to the letter I referenced earlier. Also, Jennifer says, let's all superimpose the word vagina for rear end, and does it make any difference for the listeners? This is sexual assault. We in the society think grabbing a woman's rear is just something that happens. That is from Jennifer.
By the way, Joe, Chris Cuomo knew he had done the wrong thing and immediately let her know and apologized. I'm not arguing that Chris Cuomo gets off the hook because of it, but it isn't as if we're not arguing whether it was appropriate or not, because it wasn't appropriate, and he knew it, and he was ashamed. He said so.
Well, it's not much of an apology, though, Alan. I mean, it's a short email that was designed for him to cover his bases here. It certainly did not sound particularly sincere. He seemed more apologetic to her, quote, very good and noble husband. And I just think he, you know, she called him out on it. He worried about what the pushback was going to be. But that read like a sincere apology to me.
Well, and also that he may have been caught by not realizing that the husband was there originally,
right?
As well.
Oh, I think
as offensive as the behavior.
I'm sorry.
I found the note as offensive as the behavior, which was pretty awful. But then that note, your good and noble husband. What is that? Like, I'm sorry, I intruded on his possession.
Good point.
It sounds exactly like something Andrew Cuomo would say. I think that I mean it does. they're trying
hard
to
argue
to,
that point.
They're trying to minimize something and make it seem like it was just some kind of innocent mistake, and that's exactly what Andrew Cuomo spent the last 3 months of his administration doing before he was finally forced out.
Well,
and he did that on his brother's advice.
Right.
Exactly.
And it does seem as though that's her questions in the opinion piece here bring to, you know, how do you bring him to accountability, which is how I started off this discussion. So how do you if it doesn't involve, you know, him losing his job, which she says she doesn't want. But I agree. You know, it seems like that's exactly what she wants. But the other story, but the other part of that, too, is that. For CNN and what their role is in this and what do they do? Because it seems like, you know, this, correct me if I'm wrong, anyone on the panel, but they have a problem and it keeps on getting, like, it's not going away. And at some point they're going to have to deal with it, right?
Yes. Well, it's 10:09. I predict by 11:30 or noon today, CNN will announce that they have to do an internal investigation. And then they will proactively urge people, if they have similar experiences or anything related to sexual harassment, to come forward. And I further predict that this is not an isolated one-time incident. So we'll see what happens.
Could be. And then there's also the question of ratings. If they find that people are disgusted and deserting him, I think that'll be part of their decision making, don't you?
Yeah, and advertisers.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Don't forget the advertisers.
I can never forget them. All right, let's move on. We'll go to Judith. Let's talk a little bit about John Kerry. He is a really interesting figure in the Biden administration, who is the first presidential envoy for the climate. And I can remember once on the show talking about him and his role, and since then, really nothing. There is a major piece in the New York Times about his sales pitch to save the planet, their headline, and that he wants to persuade world leaders to, quote, do what the science tells us. And as the article points out, with global climate talks less than 2 months away, he faces a tough path. So I wanted to just take a few moments to talk about his role, because even though the subject of climate change has certainly been something that the administration has dealt with in many ways, we do not hear a lot of the words of John Kerry.
Yeah, I mean, I love this article by Lisa Friedman, an excellent New York Times reporter who, if you're interested in climate change, you should be following Lisa Friedman's writing. She gets to the facts. She also has such a beautiful way of phrasing things. She describes Kerry as a pedigreed traveling salesman for the environment, shuffling from country to country with an urgent plea to save the planet. And that we haven't heard from him because he's been in 14 countries in the last 9 months, and he understands the importance of this upcoming United Nations conference in Glasgow, Scotland, which starts November 1st. This is an international issue, and we need to get international diplomacy into high gear. And I didn't know until I read this article that President Biden coaxed him out of retirement and asked him to do this role. And apparently Kerry's friends say he wasn't very good at retirement anyway. But Kerry has 35 policy experts working with him. He's working nonstop. You know, the tone of the article is, yikes, you know, this is kind of discouraging. And most notably, on climate change, we're still feeling the effects of Trump's 4 years in office, because heads of state are saying to Kerry, what happens, you know, if Trump comes back in? You know, the United States really has lost credibility on the international stage. And so there's been some hesitancy for large industrial countries that are emitting a lot of greenhouse gases, most notably India, Brazil, and China. There's some hesitancy to engage on this. But Kerry had a real victory on Tuesday of this week when China announced that they will stop financing coal projects all over the world. That's huge. And I think that's a direct result of Kerry diplomacy. I think the article is maybe a little bit more pessimistic than it needs to be, because, you know, it's this image of this guy flying commercial, schlepping around the country, trying to get audiences with the right people. And then Lisa Friedman slides in at the end that 70% of new power generation around the world, 70% of the money is being spent on renewables. And I think, again, you know, the market sees the urgency of climate change, even if the U.S. Congress doesn't. So, you know, thank goodness for John Kerry and his team of 35 really hardworking policy wonks. I'm glad they are doing this. And I hope Congress is paying attention, because, you know, Kerry has the international portfolio, but it is, again, harder for him to do his job, not just explaining the Trump administration, but if he has to explain that the U.S. Congress would not adopt the Biden climate change priorities.
Alan.
Well, that's right. I think Judith, as always on this subject, is absolutely on the money. And, you know, you could either like him or not like him. After all, this is a guy who was a presidential candidate. And a Democrat, and we have a Democrat in office. So I think his status, his stature, counts for an awful lot with people, you know, around the world who have to know that they got to get along with the United States one way or another. And that, of course, includes India and others. So I'm impressed by what Judith said.
Rosemary?
Okay, I'm trying to get back so you can hear me. I think John Kerry comes off in that article as Don Quixote on a very quixotic mission, and that's the appeal of the story. But let me remind you that that means it's a losing cause. That's clearly what she thinks. And unlike Judith, I'm not so sure that it's overly pessimistic. It's exactly pessimistic enough. He has to, he is fighting it despite the odds against him, which he knew, which makes him indeed noble, like I say, Don Quixote. But he has to get this through a Congress that won't even vote to stop guns when children are being killed in the United States. and this and we have fires and floods and storms right now in the United States, and there is absolutely no appetite for climate change legislation, witness Biden's own infrastructure bill. So I don't see that going to Scotland in November is going to change anything, despite all his hard work. I admire him. I'm glad he's doing it, but it just seems so huge a task. And he seems aware of that, too, and keeps fighting on, which makes him a hero. But we need more than a single hero now.
Terry Gibson.
Well, I have no doubt that John Kerry is doing his best and has an enormous amount of experience. I respect him, and I think he's the right person for that job. But he's not the president of the United States. And he wanted to be. He tried to be, but he's not. And what we really need right now is a president of the United States who can clearly communicate on the issue of the climate crisis that we're in and really articulate what exactly he plans to do about it and how he's going to use his power and his leadership skills to get Congress to cooperate with him. And I think this is the problem we have, is that no matter what John Kerry does, I don't currently see, unfortunately, a president who is capable of providing the type of leadership and communication that is necessary to take control on this issue and, quite frankly, many others.
Don't you have to give him a lot of credit, though, Terry, for having appointed a senior person of this quality who goes around and does what he is doing with the president's imprimatur on his forehead? I mean, it seems to me that you can't just dismiss the fact that he has taken this, that Biden has taken this step, appointed this senior guy who ran for president of the United States, who was a senator and who's one of the richest guys around, to do this work. I'm impressed by where he sits on the airplane, of course.
I certainly give him credit. I mean, he has hired and appointed a lot of very talented, highly skilled people. And that's something, of course, that Donald Trump would have never done or even known how to do. So, yes, I certainly give him credit for that. But we are at a point in time now where we do need to see action. We need to see follow through. We need to see this resonate in something more than just a New York Times article. And this story in itself is quite buried. You can't easily find it. It's not as prominent as it should be. I'd like to see Joe Biden talking more about what John Kerry is doing and what they're accomplishing working together. I'm just not hearing enough of that.
Judith, anything you'd like to respond?
Yeah, I mean, I think Terry makes some very valid points. I'm not a good judge of all of this because I read everything on climate change, but I don't think that it is penetrating mass media much. But, you know, Alan's right. I mean, having a former Secretary of State, a former U.S. Senator go all over the world carrying this message, you know, this position did not exist previously. When Kerry was Secretary of State, he did prioritize climate change along with nuclear disarmament and human rights and many other issues. So, you know, there's a saying in the climate change movement, to change everything, we need everyone. And having Kerry be part of everyone, I think, only helps us. And the science is so compelling. The economics is so compelling. We're seeing more and more big institutions divesting, not just because of the ethical call of preserving human life as we know it. You know, the planet will survive. It's the people that are having the hard time with climate change. But if you just look at the economics of this, investing in fossil fuels loses you money. And yet the New York State teachers are still invested in fossil fuels. So I think that's kind of the other divestment piece needs to move forward to lift up the work of John Kerry as he travels the globe.
But don't you think, Judith, that there is some progress here? I mean, I look at, for example, the New York State Pension Fund. You mentioned the teachers. Mm-hmm. And I do see that Tom DiNapoli has been making some moves to divest in places where he used to argue, you know, my job is to make money for the pension mm-hmm. fund. So I think maybe slowly but surely it's beginning to get done.
Joe, I just want to...
Okay, let's Judith go and then Terry, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, sorry.
Yes, it is slowly shifting, but winning slowly is losing because mm-hmm. the sure. planet is getting warmer every month, and that is a huge problem. Sea level rise is increasing every month. I mean, just looking at this past summer, you know, the evidence of climate change is all over the world. And so I think, you know, as we've talked about on the show, the political feedback loop doesn't work. I mean, it's not working on the pandemic, right? I mean, a third of the nation still not vaccinated, and it's not really working fast enough on climate change. Attitudes are changing. The private marketplace is changing, which is perhaps most important. But we are, you know, we're not changing fast enough.
So why so slow to get to people, Judith?
I think there's a profound lack of political leadership on the climate change issue. I think Terry is right. You know, I think Biden has appointed great people. I think many, not all, but many of his policies on climate are very good. But it hasn't really kind of penetrated. I was talking to someone just yesterday, the incredible rainstorms that we're experiencing. And you still have a lot of people saying, oh, well, that's just the weather. Well, it's not just the weather. So it's, I mean, we have a lot of education to do, but more importantly, the role of fossil fuel companies in policymaking in Congress and in campaign contributions, I think, is the major thing standing in the way. The political influence of fossil fuel companies and their continued attempts at disinformation is a huge problem. Final point, former Congress member Sherry Bollert from the Utica area passed away earlier this week, age 83. He was such a Republican champion on acid rain issues. It wasn't that long ago you could get Republicans to support reducing air pollution in order to reverse acid rain. And I was thinking of his legacy and then fast forwarding to the political quagmire we're in today on climate change.
Terry.
Well, I think Judith got to what I was going to say, and she probably did it in a much more eloquent way than I'm going to do it. But I did want to point out that while we're having this very important discussion, the fossil fuel lobbying organizations are working in aggressive ways that it's hard, I think, for the average voter to understand. They are making substantial commitments to political parties and to political candidates that they will support them if they support their pro-fossil fuel legislation. And they are making commitments to political action committees that if this particular political candidate does not support our fossil fuel legislation, we will support running ads against them and do everything we can to get them out of office. These things are really happening, and they have enormous influence, unfortunately, because of our lax campaign finance laws. They have enormous influence over the people that will ultimately mm-hmm. make the decisions. And mm-hmm. many of these people that are being influenced are Democrats. And where we really need to see significant change is in the behavior of our elected officials in both parties in terms of how they actually take climate change seriously and pass laws to help us deal with this. And until we see that movement, it's going to be a scary time. And that's where I'm looking for the real change to happen. And I look to Joe Biden to jump in there and take control of that situation and to get it done. And I'm just not seeing that.
Well, we have about 3.5 minutes before we have to go to a break. So I'm going to release this story to the world, which I just it's one of my favorite stories of the day. Senator Chuck Grassley, the oldest GOP senator at the age of 88 years old, has announced he will seek another term.
I say as an 80-year-old.
Go ahead, Alan.
As an 80-year-old, I say good for him.
Good for him. So he would be elected at 80. Help me out here. He'd be elected at 80.
94, 95.
95, yeah.
Yeah, so if he runs next year.
Yeah. All right.
Great.
One of my least favorite people.
The avowed ages of this group, I must speak out. I think it's abominable. Dianne Feinstein running at her advanced age has done harm to her district and to her legacy by running when she is no longer competent to be a senator. And Grassley is even worse. He's showing signs of slowing down and not understanding and being manipulated by others in the party already. This is just horrible. I hope the people in his district will see through it and not vote for him. This is the Republicans trying to hold on to a seat, and they don't care whether the guy's competent at all. They're just counting numbers. It's so damn cynical. I just wanted to scream when I read this. We have had more than a number of occasions when we have seen what happens when people incompetent due to age or injury remain in our legislature. We need real minds working there, and this is not someone who is up to par anymore.
He tweeted at 4 a.m. this morning. He said, "In Iowa, I'm running. I am jogging. And I do that 6 days a week before I start a day. And I want you to know that Barbara and I have decided I'm running for re-election. A lot more to do for Iowa. We ask and will work for your support. Will you join us?" Terry.
Oh, God.
Well, I've never been a person that has liked his work. He is extremely conservative. He is condescending. He's arrogant. The way that he treats women, the way that he treats all of the people that work for him, his staff, just the way he presents himself, I've never been a big fan. And the fact that our country has to be in a situation where a representative, a senator from Iowa of all places, has such seniority over the future of our country, to me, is terrifying. And I say all of that regardless of if he was 20, I would feel the same way. He's 80. The age part of it is not a concern to me. It's the actual just the interest and the skill set of this individual, I think, has done great harm for our country.
So the age part is not of concern to you because the remarks that have been given so far have a lot to do with age. And I think
I'm not in that camp. I seen him consistently behave in ways that I think are inappropriate for a senator, regardless of his age.
And well, you're certainly right about that.
I think it was long past time for him to go.
Judith, did I miss your remarks on this?
No, I mean,
I
agree with Terry. I mean, Grassley is just a dreadful public servant. I'm sure Barbara just wants him out of the house. and, you know, it all depends on whether, you know, people at an advanced age are physically and mentally up to the job. I mean, Bernie Sanders is a little on the old side, and I'm not calling on for Bernie Sanders to step down. But, I mean, Rosemary is correct. Sometimes people, as they age, you know, lose a step or two, and are they really up to the grueling schedule? Alan, you'll remember this story. Many years ago, there was an elderly New York State senator giving a speech on the floor of the
Senate.
John
Markey.
Well, I'm thinking of another, and part of his speech on the Senate floor, he talked about the 48 states, and a couple people yelled out, "It's 50 states."
That's changed
like a little glimpse into, you know, maybe people are not on the top of their game when
by the way,
in
movies are in color now. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll wrap up, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion for this morning. Last go around with our group, and we have some letters, so I want to get to those, and then we'll move on to our final topic for the morning. We go to Irene, who says, go John Kerry. I hope we hear lots more from him and what he is working on. I think he has political will and has dedicated his life to public service. He has credibility. Catherine says, if people don't get it, the physical damage of climate change to our infrastructure, homes, and lands will reach the point where we cannot afford to repair the damage. We can't get an infrastructure bill passed, let alone have funds to help people whose condo collapsed or house gets flooded or car gets washed away in a flood. Then there is this from Joan. John Kerry started a nonprofit called WW0 and battles climate change. I don't think he was retired before he took this job in the Biden administration. He is committed to fight the fight. Then, let's see, Jean says the GOP is the only major political party on earth that denies climate change is man-made. Republicans are an existential threat to the planet and our democracy. And last but certainly not least is the letter from Lillian. Okay, tell me how you sanctimonious limo liberals can reconcile Donald Trump's egregious assaults against women and not constantly remind the listening public about it.
That would be an electric limo for us.
Anyone want to take on William's letter? No? Okay.
We do it all the time. We're always bashing on Trump.
It's been
That's
covered.
Just crazy. Yeah. Covered, done. Yes.
All
it
right.
Without saying.
Here we go. We want to talk about January 6th. The House January 6th committee has issued subpoenas for Trump aides and advisors, including Meadows and Scavino. This story from late yesterday, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol has issued subpoenas to former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and former Deputy Chief of Staff Dan Scavino, as well as Kash Patel, who was serving as Chief of Staff to the Acting Defense Secretary that day. An additional subpoena targets longtime Trump advisor Steve Bannon. The subpoenas were announced Thursday evening by the committee, which has moved its inquiry into a new, more aggressive stage after requesting White House records last month and sending preservation requests for records to telecom and social media companies. Trump and his team have condemned the Select Committee's inquiry since it began, vowing to fight its demands for documents and interviews with claims of executive privilege. A debate about the former president's ability to restrict access to information on individuals has already begun in Washington and is likely to become dramatically more intense now that these first subpoenas have been issued. Alan.
Well, the subpoenas are very important. Whether the kind of frustration that we have all seen, Joe, up until now continues, in which there's a denial, it gets into the court process, I don't have a lot of faith in it because I'm just disgusted with how Trump, with all his behavior, has gotten off the hook. And this is going to be extended to the people who are working with him and for him. He'll argue executive privilege. I'm delighted that the Congress is doing it. I think it's great. But in fact, I'm from Missouri. You got to show me.
Mm. Rosemary.
Yeah, I totally agree with Alan. Remember his tax forms? Yeah, we were right to ask for those. And that was, 6 years ago now almost, and we don't have them. The Democrats continue to use the processes set up by statute and by the Constitution, and that means going through the court system, and so we're years away from actually getting anything, even if they should prevail. Meanwhile, Trump and his lawyers and their six-point memos are proceeding to dismantle our election system, and there's nothing stopping them, and they're going, I think, to get away with it. This whole, we didn't talk about it today, but the audit in Arizona, yeah, seen from the beginning as a farce, came out and said, yeah, Biden actually did win, and that doesn't even matter, because Texas is now going to do an audit. And the whole thing is geared to making sure that the elections coming up go in Trump's favor. I think he's going to run, and he's making sure that he's going to win. And that's a lot more important to him than, you know, battling this little fight in in court about producing records. I think we know as much about what happened as we're going to from the journalist book, from the new Costa and Bob Woodward book. And they got it without using subpoenas, by the way. Let me point that out. So I think that it's sit around. That was all that took over the news last night. Everyone crowing. Oh, isn't this great? You know, Congress is no. It's an unbalanced fight, and Democrats continue to use old slow systems, and Trump and his allies are using new, scary, effective ways. And I'll even take that into abortion. It looked like they were losing abortion, and so slowly, the court's now 6-3 in favor of abortion, filled with people who are appointed because they were against abortion. And we have Texas launching an assault that bypasses courts altogether. That's pretty clever, and that's the way the Trump side is winning and working. So this is, to me, nothing.
Terry Gibson.
I don't know if I'd call it nothing, but I do worry that Democrats are going to go down this rabbit hole, and instead of focusing their energy on actually passing new legislation that deals with climate change, that deals with voting rights, that deals with the debt ceiling, that deals with infrastructure, that's where their priority and focus and all of their messaging should be right now. Because if they want to win elections, they're going to have to show that they're capable of running a government. They're not going to win elections by doing investigations. These investigations are important. But the results of them, whatever they may be, are not going to put forth a message that's going to get the country excited about reelecting Democrats enough to hold on to the majority they have. And so I'm very concerned about that.
And Judith.
Yeah, I mean, it's good they issued these subpoenas. I'd love to see Mark Meadows' records from that day. But Rosemary is absolutely correct. Trump and his allies are really penetrating every level of government. They seem quite content on destabilizing democracy around the country. I thought it was really interesting when this Arizona recount was done, Joe Biden actually got more votes than was originally reported, but that won't stop them. They'll go on to the next state as they are. And it's kind of, there are parallels to climate change and people not getting vaccinated in terms of members of Congress in January 6th. I mean, these members of Congress were under direct physical threat. I'm sure they were all very concerned about their safety. And yet, because of the political culture wars that we're in, they're willing to overlook that. Remember, there are only two Republicans that were willing to serve on this committee, Liz Cheney and the other guy whose name starts with K. And if someone remembers, and, you know, they're not even willing to hold people account when their own self-interest is at stake. By the way, Bennington College is doing a really interesting 6-part series examining January 6th and what it means long-term for democratic institutions. There's a lot there, yet I think a large part of the public is ready to move on. That's the reality. So Terry's right. Let's pass a really strong budget reconciliation bill. Let's not let government shut down on September 30th, which is a real possibility if Congress does not pass the federal budget. Federal agencies were told yesterday to start preparing for a government shutdown in the middle of a pandemic. Democrats need to show that they can govern and make a real difference in the everyday life of most Americans. And I think people are more interested in that than January 6th.
Meanwhile, in another reality, we were talking about Arizona a moment ago, and the count in Arizona that both Judith and Rosemary referenced. The former president of the United States, Donald Trump, sent out a press release about 12 minutes ago that said huge findings in Arizona. However, the fake news media is already trying to, quote, call it again for Biden before actually looking at the facts, just like they did in November. The audit has uncovered significant and undeniable evidence of fraud, that in shouty caps. Until we know how and why this happened, our elections will never be the same. This is a major criminal event and should be investigated by the Attorney General immediately. The Senate's final report will be released today at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I have heard it is far different than being reported by the fake news media.
I have
this
heard.
This guy is a Hitlerian liar. That's what he is. We do know what the findings were, and they found that he lost a few votes. So it's extraordinary that he continues to do it. And there are people who laugh at him, but I'm not laughing. Don't laugh at the people in history like Hitler, like Mussolini, who got to power doing just this kind of lying.
Anyone else?
Yeah, this his uproar and chaos making in Arizona has nothing to do with 2020. It has everything to do with 2024. And he wants as much controversy as possible. He's brought in Texas now. Pennsylvania could come next. And the whole idea is to switch control of elections over to legislatures, which are overwhelmingly Republican. And Democrats are continuing to do the same thing, to just pay attention. Accountability, we call it, but it really is just focusing on what's already done. The time to go after the January 6th insurrectionists was with impeachment or with the Justice Department going after the people that they arrested. And we didn't do that. So what can Congress do? The one ray of hope that I have seen this week came from John Yarmuth. He's a Democrat from Kentucky. I didn't even know they had such things. It's like a unicorn. And he's head of the House Budget Committee. And he's saying, why do we have to have a debt ceiling? We're the only country in the world that has a statutory debt limit. Every place else, it's like you have a law that says you have to pay the debts you incur. And it doesn't do anything. It was installed about 100 years ago in order to tamp down on the debt. Obviously, that doesn't work because every 6 months we have this fight about raising the debt ceiling. So why don't Democrats in control right now pass a law saying no more debt ceiling? From now on, we just pay our bills as they come due. That would solve the whole thing, and it would take away this weapon that actually both parties use against the others to hold up things and get what they want. That's the sort of out-of-the-box creative thinking that we are not seeing from Democrats and scarily are seeing all the time from Trump and other Republicans.
The other piece of breaking news that just came out at 10:45 this morning, so a minute and 30 seconds ago, New York State Attorney General Letitia James has released a statement after the New York County State Supreme Court unsealed an order that forces the Trump Organization to comply with the Office of the Attorney General subpoenas, otherwise face a third-party firm to oversee the identification, collection, and review of electronically stored information. Tish James said, for more than a year now, the Trump Organization has failed to adequately respond to our subpoenas, hiding behind procedural delays and excuses. Once again, the court has ordered that the Trump Organization must turn over the information and documents we are seeking, otherwise face an independent third party that will ensure that takes place. Our work will continue undeterred because no one is above the law. How serious is that, or can they play more games still?
She's terrific. She's terrific. She's doing a great job. But to her statement, I would say, you want to bet?
Yeah. Terry?
I think that the accountability, the people that need to be holding the Trump Organization accountable are exactly the attorney generals. I think Tish James is doing the right thing, and that's where we should look to hold these individuals accountable. We should not look to Congress to do it. Congress should be focused on getting new laws and legislation passed and moving us away from the Trump administration instead of getting sucked back into it as they continue to allow themselves to do.
Judith?
So last night, the New York State Archives hosted Tish James, our attorney general, interviewing former Attorney General Bob Abrams.
Yeah.
And it was so refreshing. I know Lucas Willard reported on this, but to see two, you know, current and former attorney general, the epitome of honest and competent public servants. It was so nice to see. So I'm glad she's staying on these Trump accountability efforts. And I think a lot of the trail was blazed by Bob Abrams when he served as such a distinguished attorney general in New York.
And Rosemary.
No, I don't. I'm sorry. I don't think I have anything to add to that. I as Alan says, I was listening intently to what others had to say.
Yeah. Sounds good. All right. We'll call it then for this Friday morning. My thanks to everybody for being with us. Alan Chartok, thank you so much. We'll be back Monday, and we'll start.
Don't forget that lockbox.
Big collection in the lockbox. And we welcome you to help out on that panel. Or WAMC.org. That's where you go. WAMC.org. Judith, Rosemary, Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a beautiful weekend. Thanks. We'll be right back.